concerned with building democracy from below the way it should be done. But there's, of course, a counterforce, which is dedicated to destroying democracy from above. Can't hear me? I'm going to start over. I said that many of us here are dedicated to building democracy from below, which is the way to do it. There's, of course, a counterforce regularly dedicated to destroying democracy from above. We can learn quite a lot about this constant struggle from the Obama administration, despite in the short months in which it's been in office. It pretty strongly confirms some classic theses on these matters, both with respect to domestic and foreign policy, and how they're formed and implemented. And these are matters that I think should be thought through carefully if we hope to find a way forward. So start with domestic issues. There is an important observation by Adam Smith. He's, of course, speaking of England, and he said that in England, the principal architects of policy, who were the merchants and manufacturers, make sure that their own interests are most peculiarly attended to, however grievous the impact on others, including the people of England, but most crucially, he said, those who are subject to the savage injustice of the Europeans. He was thinking specifically of British India. If Smith is correct, we should expect to find what's called a democratic deficit, that is, a gap between public opinion and public policy. And in fact, the scale of the democratic deficit is a pretty good measure of how accurate Smith's observation was and remains. And we do find that substantial on both domestic and foreign policy. And I think if we look closer, we find that Adam Smith's observation is remarkably accurate 250 years later. Well, this question arose in the formation of the United States in the Constitutional Convention. The framers were concerned with just this issue, and particularly James Madison, the most influential and in many ways the most eloquent of them. Madison argued that democracy is a danger and we have to guard against it. He gave as his, he considered the model of England. In England, of course, it's the natural model in the 1780s. In England, he said, if it was a democracy, if people could really vote, the large majority of the poor would use their voting power to take away the property of the rich. They would carry out what we would nowadays call land reform, break up the huge land and estates, give land to the yeomen and so on, peasants. And he said that would obviously be unjust because they would be taking property from the rich. So therefore, democracy is a threat, and we have to try to avoid it in the new society that we're creating. And in fact, if you look at the constitutional framework that Madison was influential in establishing of the three branches of government, the legislative branch was the most significant, unlike today. The executive was supposed to be an administrator. And within the legislative branch, it was the Senate that was powerful. The reason is that the Senate was the most remote, removed from the population. House is too close to the population, shouldn't have power. The Senate, Madison said, should be in the hands of the wealth of the nation, the most responsible set of men, people who have sympathy for property owners and their rights, and that way we can ensure that the government will meet its obligation to protect the minority of the opulent against the majority. These are quotes from Madison. to the Constitutional Convention. As I say, we won't face the problem that England would have faced if it were democratic. Now, I don't know if Madison was aware of it or not, but he was reiterating a problem that's discussed in the first work on politics, the first major work on politics, namely Aristotle's Politics. Aristotle was talking about Athens, a free city in the sense that the new United States was a free country, a narrow sense of freedom. It was free for property, white males, okay, just like our country. And for Athens, Aristotle considered the various kinds of government you could have. He didn't particularly like any of them, but he said the least bad, the most preferable would be democracy. However, he noted a flaw in democracy, exactly what Madison later referred to. He said if Athens were a democracy, the property white males, most of the poor, would use their voting power to take away the property of the narrow class of rich, to divide it up or more equally and so on. And like Madison, he thought that would be unjust. Well, Madison and Aristotle faced the same problem, but they reached opposite conclusions. Aristotle advocated there's a conflict, both noted, between democracy and inequality. Aristotle advocated getting rid of the inequality. He proposed what amount to welfare state measures, providing food to the large majority, public meals, other forms of eliminating inequality, so the population would be mostly middle class. And then you wouldn't have to face this dilemma of the poor using their voting power to take away the property of the rich. And Madison reached the opposite conclusion. We should reduce democracy. That's the reason for the constitutional framework that he established with power in the hands of the wealth of the nation. Now, in Madison's defense, he was basically pre-capitalist in mentality. When he spoke of the power being in the hands of the wealth of the nation, he thought that these would be disinterested public servants, benevolent gentlemen, aristocrats, enlightened aristocrats. Actually, Smith had a sharper eye at the same time. He saw what they would do. This conflict between two views of the fundamental problem runs right through history, American history. It's a major theme right to the present. Well, for Madison, remember, there ought to be a democratic deficit. That is, the public opinion and public policy should be widely separated. Actually, that's, from his point of view, not a flaw, but a merit of the system that he was framing. And to the present, it's a strongly advocated thesis among elite sectors in the business world and intellectual circles, actually pretty much across the spectrum. We have a major industry in the country. It's called the public relations industry, which is dedicated explicitly to this principle. It was founded mostly in the 1920s, that's when it really took off, on the principles that were explained by its leading figure, its leading figures, Edward Bernays, who wrote a book called Propaganda. That term was used freely in those days. It didn't have the negative connotations. It was picked up in the 30s, so it just meant advertising. And he said that propaganda is a very important tool. It can be used by the intelligent minorities to ensure that they run the country properly without being disturbed by the rest. Well, I guess that's the Madisonian principle. He didn't bother to add that the intelligent minorities gain this power by service to authentic power. Other intelligent minorities don't. But that's his principle. And if you move, he was a liberal, progressive, Wilson, Roosevelt, Kennedy, progressive. And the same was true of intellectuals of the 20th century, and in fact right to the present. So perhaps the most influential and important of them was Walter Lippmann, the leading public intellectual of the 20th century. Also Wilson, Roosevelt, Kennedy, progressive. He wrote a book called Progressive Essays on Democracy, in which he advocated essentially the same principle. He said that the public can only be spectators of action, not participants. The participants have to be the responsible men, and they have to be protected from what he called the trampling and the roar of the bewildered herd. They have to be protected from that. The bewildered herd are the ignorant and meddlesome majority of the population. None of their business to govern the country, and in fact it would be dangerous for them to do so because they would make the wrong decisions. The right decisions are made by the intelligent minority, us smart guys. Those are the best and the brightest of Camelot or the Straussian neocons of the last decade, or the Lenin's Vanguard, which had a very similar conception. Or in fact, whoever holds or serves power. And that's it. Natural and consistent theme that runs through their writings and the doctrines and ideology. Back in the 19th century, Bakunin came out with one of the few significant predictions in the social sciences that was overwhelmingly verified, ought to be known and studied for that reason alone. He observed that there's the rise of what he called a new class of scientific intelligentsia. And he predicted, meaning what we call intellectuals and technocratic elites and other terms, he predicted that they would move in one of two directions. Some of them would seek to gain power on the backs of worker and peasant struggles. And when they gained power, they would become what he called the red bureaucracy, the most brutal and repressive regime in history. And others, with the same assumptions, would recognize that they're not going to gain power that way, so they would become servants of power. They would become the technocratic elite of the formerly known the democratic capitalist societies. Both groups would, in his words, beat the people with the people's state, either in a people's democracy of the Leninist type or a capitalist democracy of the Western type. It's a pretty accurate prediction. In fact, it's hard to find one that's comparably accurate. Well, going back to Smith's maxim, we don't live in the 1770s. Now it's not the merchants and manufacturers who are the principal architects of policy, but multinational corporations, and in the past 30 years particularly, financial institutions. Their role in the U.S. economy has risen from maybe 3% of gross domestic product around 1970 to probably 10 times that much today, 30% or over. That's one of the products of what's called the neoliberal period. It's a very, not just accidents that happen. These are policy decisions, state corporate policy decisions, which have changed the economy considerably. In the 1970s, capital was freed from controls. Productive sectors of the economy began to be shifted abroad. Still plenty of profit for the owners and managers, but nothing for the less and less for the working class and communities. Workers around the world are set into competition with one another, which of course has the consequence of driving down wages and benefits. Professionals, meanwhile, are protected from competition, and owners and managers enrich themselves beyond the dreams of avarice. That's what's called globalization. And it has predictable consequences, including perhaps the greatest inequality in the country's history. A perfectly predictable consequence of these policies. There is a question, however, about lurking in the background. How do the financial institutions and owners and directors and managers of the multinational corporations, and how do they become the principal architects of policy? Well, there are many ways, but the simplest way is just by buying elections. That's pretty straightforward. In fact, if you look at the United States, the consequences are striking. Incumbents in Congress are reelected by something like 98 or 99%. That's at a time when popular attitudes towards Congress, approval of Congress is in the low teens. Well, how does that happen? One is they outspend their opponents. In fact, a very good predictor of elections, remarkably good predictor, is who spends most in the campaign. So take Obama. His funding was concentrated primarily, the core of his funding was in financial institutions, the core element of the economy since the neoliberal period. And they much preferred him to McCain. He outspent McCain primarily thanks to their contributions, especially in the last couple months in the swing states, which affected the polls. Well, what would we expect then, assuming Adam Smith's maxim? That we would expect that the financial institutions would have their interests most peculiarly attended to in the Obama administration. And in fact, that's exactly what happened. There is a sophisticated version of, modern sophisticated version of these theses. It's called the investment theory of politics, developed by Thomas Ferguson, a very fine political economist. And what he suggests that we regard elections as periodic occasions in which groups of investors coalesce and invest to buy the state. And the prediction is that, well, that's going to determine policy. And it's a remarkably good predictor over more than a century. It's good work on this by him and others. Obama is a good example. Well, to see what's happened, a good place to look is the business press. They tend to have very good reporting, pretty accurate reporting, and they're very illuminating. There's one reason why they, several reasons why they have good reporting. One is their audience. Their audience is the people who own the world, and they have to have a tolerably realistic picture of the world. The ignorant and meddlesome outsiders can be deluded in one way or another, but for the wealth of the nation, it's important to know to get the facts straight. So you have very good reporting, illuminating reporting in the business press. Another reason is to just trust their audience. So you can tell them the truth, they'll won't get any funny ideas from them. In the last couple of months, the business press has been very illuminating. So back in early August, Business Week, major business weekly, had a cover story with a headline. It said, the health insurers have already won. That's early August. And they're exulting. It's clear already that they're getting virtually everything they want. They're getting universal coverage, which is fine. They get more customers. They get public government subsidies, public subsidies for no meaningful regulation and no public option. The reasons, incidentally, are very frank. They can't allow a public option because they won't be able to compete. It will be too efficient and cheap, and they'll be driven out of the market. That's interestingly given quite openly and frankly as the reason, and they're probably correct. When Medicare came along in the 60s, it did drive the private insurers pretty much out of that market because they just couldn't compete with it. So we have to stop a public option, and it's pretty well dead. Well, what does the public think about all of this? I mean, there have been polls on these issues for decades, and a large majority of the public pretty consistently has been in favor of some kind of national health care of the kind that every other industrial country has, either just plain public or heavily regulated, very tightly regulated networks of private insurers like Switzerland. It's essentially the same. It's a public option. It means a sort of Medicare for all in one form or another. Well, that's by far been the most popular view among the public. It's occasionally, it's not on the agenda. Obama made it very clear right at the beginning. That's not even under discussion. The ignorant and meddlesome outsiders don't know what they're talking about. And it's occasionally discussed in the press, rarely, but occasionally. It's that's described as politically impossible or lacking political support. It's the description in the New York Times. Well, technically that's correct. Political support does not mean support from the ignorant and meddlesome outsiders, the spectators. It means support from the minority of the opulent, who must be protected from the majority, as Madison put it. So yes, it does lack political support in that sense. What about the narrower notion of public option? Very narrow. But what does the public think about that? Well, according to the latest polls, 2 weeks ago, it's still supported by about 2-1. But it's recognized that it's, you know, they may still be talking about it, but it's not going to happen. Lacks political support. What about the drug prices? They're about twice as high in the United States as comparable countries. And there's a reason for it. This is the only country where the government is barred by law from negotiating, using its massive purchasing power to negotiate prices with the big pharmaceutical corporations. Actually, it's not totally true. Like, the Veterans Administration can do it, so they have much lower drug prices. But the rest of for the society as a whole, they can't, they're barred by law. So sure, drug prices are much higher. What does the public think about this? Well, about 85% is opposed, thinks the government should have the right, as in other countries or in the Veterans Administration, to negotiate drug prices, just as the Pentagon has the right to negotiate prices for paperclips using its purchasing power. That's barred for the ignorant and meddlesome outsiders. There's a lot of talk now about cost control. You know, you've got to keep the costs of health care under the magic $1 trillion. But this discussion is completely beside the point. If the public will were observed, you wouldn't have a problem of rising costs, you would have lowering costs. Drug prices would fall. There's every reason to expect that a public managed health care, public health care, would be much less expensive. And we can see that from just comparative evidence. The U.S. is not the only country in the world. There are a lot of industrial countries, comparable countries. U.S. health care is roughly twice as high per capita as comparable countries, and the outcomes are among the worst. Well, there's a reason for that. The private insurers are very highly bureaucratized, a lot of surveillance, supervision, meddling with doctors' decisions, administrative costs are out of sight. It's a very inefficient system, so sure, costs are very high. What it costs, the way to do it is eliminate the inefficiencies most in the private sector and reduce drug prices. But those are not options. As I say, Obama made it explicit. He made it explicit that he has a secret deal, he tells, with the drug companies not to permit any possibility of government negotiation of drug prices. Well, so of course, health insurance and pharmaceutical corporations are exulting. They've already won. Actually, these numbers in the polls are artificially low because these issues are never discussed, barely discussed, only marginal circles. So people who are giving those answers in polls are probably assuming I'm the only person in the world who believes this. No, they don't hear it anyway. In a functioning democracy, there would be a discussion about these matters, and people wouldn't feel alone, isolated, helpless. But that hasn't happened. That's an enormous elite success, as is eliminating a badly needed reform. Now, it's understood that this is likely to tank the economy. economy, healthcare costs are going up way faster than the gross domestic product, and it'll overwhelm the economy, but that's down the road, and it's irrelevant. Now, that's not because the principal architects of policy are bad people, perfectly nice people. It's just that there's an institutional imperative not to consider that. If you do consider that, you're out of the game. So you either don't consider it and stay in the game, or you're out. So therefore, what is left is not considering. Sure, it will tank the economy, but that's someone else's problem. Our institutional structure requires maximizing profit and power in the short run, and there are all kind of perverse incentives that magnify that effect. Well, that's healthcare. What about the banks and the investment firms, core of the financial sector? Well, you read the business press, they're exulting too. They're delighted. Profits and bonuses are shooting up. You know, you read the major press, you get front page headlines like a couple of days ago. In the flurry of big merger deals, signs of restored confidence. New York Times, investors are eager to take risky investments and so on. Well, why not? Makes good sense. There's a huge public bailout, no meaningful regulation, and there's a significant increase in the government insurance policy, which is called too big to fail, which is, of course, an insurance policy. It's increased enormously, and it's understood. Actually, a very good economics correspondent of the New York Times, Gretchen Morgenstern, calls this too big to take on. In other words, big firms are too powerful to allow the government insurance policy to be discussed. Well, what's the consequence? Actually, the mainstream press describes it so accurately, I'll just quote them instead of paraphrasing. So a couple of days ago, banks, headline, banks too big to fail have grown even bigger. The behemoths born of the bailout reduce consumer choice, tempt corporate moral hazard, meaning risky investments. When the credit crisis struck last year, federal regulators pumped tens of billions of dollars into the nation's leading financial institution because the banks were so big that officials feared their failure would ruin the entire financial system. Today, the biggest of these banks are even bigger. The crisis may be turning out very well for many of the behemoths that dominate U.S. finance. A series of federally arranged mergers safely landed troubled banks on the decks of more stable firms, and it allowed the survivors to emerge from the turmoil with strengthened market position, giving them even greater control over consumer lending and more potential to profit. These mergers were largely the government's making. Regulators pushed failing mortgage lenders and Wall Street firms into the arms of even bigger banks and handed out billions of dollars to ensure that the deals would go through. The oligopoly has tightened. And then it goes on to point out that the really big banks, which are even bigger now thanks to government intervention, can get credit at much lower interest rates than the smaller banks that serve communities and so on. So they're prospering while the regional and the community banks are struggling and falling steadily. So you get a huge impact on profitability. That's why Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan Chase are reporting a huge surge in profit during the last quarter. The Center for Economic and Policy Research, which does extremely good work on this, get up online. They've just issued a report showing pretty convincingly that subsidies for the too-big-to-fail institutions constitute a substantial redistribution of money from taxpayers to the very banks that were bailed out this year, with grievous effects on the public and on community banks that serve the public, and in fact on everyone who is in what we might call the too smart small to care about factor. Meddlesome outsiders, the spectators. Well, too big to fail is an insurance policy. It magnifies a well-known built-in inefficiency of the markets. A very simple, straightforward inefficiency. Say there's a transaction, say you sell me a car, we might make a good deal for ourselves, but we don't take into account the effect on others. That's not part of a market transaction. And there is an effect on others. You sell me a car, and increases pollution, congestion, raises the price of gas, and so on. What economists call externalities, put in footnotes. But the externalities can be huge. In the financial institutions, they're enormous. So, for example, if Goldman Sachs makes, a risky loan, if they're managed properly, they take into account the possible loss to themselves if it goes bad, but they don't take into account what's called systemic risk, the effects on the whole system if their loans go bad. And that's pretty much what's just happened. There's it means that risk is underpriced. There's more of it than there should be. That systemic risk is in fact what just happened in the last couple of years, and that did lead to a very severe financial crisis. There's nothing obscure about this. It's understood, well understood. About 10 years ago, there was a good book on it by two well-known prestigious economists, John Eatwell, Lance Taylor, discussing, called Global Finance at Risk, talking about the likely consequences of the underpricing of risk because of the failure to take into account systemic risk. Of course, that could be overcome in principle by tight regulation, but that wasn't happening. Alan Greenspan, used to be called St. Alan, not any longer, back in the late 60s during the tech bubble, he did use the phrase irrational exuberance. He said, worried about the market, kind of irrational exuberance. And he's been recently criticized for that, for not having acted on it. But that's the wrong criticism. It's his phrase that was wrong. It was perfect irrational exuberance. There's every reason to take great risks if you know that the public's going to bail you out if it goes bad. That's the too big to fail insurance policy. So it's perfectly rational exuberance. Doesn't matter. You can't lose. If you lose, you're too big to fail. So you get a public bailout and you end up even stronger than you were before. As in fact, just happened. So there's nothing irrational about it. It's perverse, but it's not irrational. And it, in fact, follows pretty straightforwardly from Adam Smith's maxim applied to financial institutions. Well, of course, as the business press also points out, that this just sets the stage for the next and worst crisis. But it's an institutional decision. It's kind of like healthcare. You don't take into account like the consequences for the society as a whole, just as you don't take into account systemic risk or externalities and other transactions. These are just built-in market inefficiencies exacerbated by perverse incentives, too big to fail insurance policies and others. Well, these are all part of the neoliberal programs that have been instituted since the 1970s. One aspect of that has been financialization of the economy. Another has been state corporate programs to transfer production abroad, set workers in competition with each other, which of course drives wages and benefits down. Meanwhile, protecting professionals and educated sectors in all sorts of ways and enriching owners and managers. It's what's called globalization. And it has obvious effects. Some of the effects are almost surreal. So if you read the front pages now, that General Motors and other manufacturers are dismantling plants, which means destroying the lives of the workforce, the families, and the communities. So that's what they're doing here. And meanwhile, Obama's Secretary of Transportation is traveling around Europe, going to Spain, France, and so on, trying to get Spain to use federal stimulus money to provide high-speed transport for the United States. High-speed transport could be produced in the factories that GM and others are dismantling, but that's not as profitable to the financial institutions. They'd rather have us use taxpayer money to get Spain to provide us with the high technology that could very well be produced here. I mean, it can be done. There'd have to be some conversion, but this, nothing like what's happened in the past. During the Second World War, for example, industry was rapidly converted to wartime production, very successful. It was a kind of a semi-command economy, extremely successful, the most successful in economic history. It ended the Depression, production roughly quadrupled, it set the stage for the very substantial growth period in the first couple of decades after the Second World War. Egalitarian growth in that case, which was unusual. Do we have to accept this? Actually not. You know, it's perfectly possible to violate any economic laws for the workforce and the communities to just take over the factories and to use them to produce. That doesn't fit the goals of the principal architect's policy. And if we insist on the Madisonian compact, you know, got to protect the minority of the opulent, well, of course, it's ruled out. But that's not a law of nature, and it's not a law of economics. I mean, you take a look at the standard texts on corporations, and they point out that there's no principle of economics that says that businesses, corporations should be run in the interest of shareholders. And shareholders doesn't mean somebody who's got a couple of shares from a pension fund. It means the highly concentrated stock ownership of the top 1%, or in fact, 0.5% of the population. No law that says that corporations have to run in their interest. It could be run in the interest of what they call stakeholders, the workforce, community, who are involved in the corporation in some manner. And it's been tried. 30 years ago, there was a major case in Youngstown, Ohio. The U.S. Steel was closing down a major plant. It's a steel town, destroying the community. There was serious protest, sit-ins, demonstrations, and others trying to maintain the plant. And finally, there was an effort to let the community and the workforce take over the plant, just buy it out from U.S. Steel and run it. Now that went to the courts, and they lost in the courts, but with more popular support, they could win. And that could change the nature, that kind of thing could change the nature of the economy considerably. Well, it's not on the agenda, but that's because of the lack of the sort of popular education and activism which would put it on the agenda. It's come close many times in the past. During the 1930s, the sit-down strikes were particularly frightening to industry because they're just a step before taking the factory over and running it yourself. And in fact, that's when the New Deal measures were enacted with business support, wanted to cut off that dangerous option. And it's true too now. Well, what's the next step? The business press is happy to inform us. The energy corporations have learned from the success of the healthcare insurers and are telling us that they're planning a similar campaigns. They're planning similar campaigns, the kind of just seen, campaigns, all that, to try to block even the mild energy environmental programs that are being considered in Congress. They want to block them. And they're being backed by the Chamber of Commerce and other, you know, the major business lobbying organization and other business lobbies. I think this is it's a good technique. We can use it too to block environmental and energy efficiency programs. And they're saying it, you don't have to make it up. They're telling us, they're nice of them. They also know that consequences that will lead to maybe a turn. terminal crisis for the species, but it just isn't irrelevant. It just is not relevant. Again, not bad people. These are just inherent in the structure of the institutions. You don't play that game, you're out. Those are imperatives. Well, one consequence of the democratic deficit is that it's very important for the political and economic managers to keep issues out of the elections. The reason is they know that there's a democratic deficit on issues the public doesn't agree, so keep them out of the elections. So elections have to concentrate on personalities, on the rhetorical style, gossip, and so on. The 2008 election is a perfect example of that. There's almost no substance to it, just slogans and style. And there were some slogans. The slogans were hope and change. That's completely predictable. Party managers read the polls. They know that the polls say that 80% of the country think we're going the wrong direction. So what's your slogan for the campaign? Hope and change. That's McCain's slogan too. Carry it off as well. But they recognize the advertising industry that gives an award for the best marketing campaign of the year. For 2008, it went to Amman. Yeah, Apple computers. It caused a lot of euphoria in the business world. It was fairly reported in the business press, London Financial Times, they described euphoria among executives after the poll came out because they agreed. They said this is a terrific technique. It's going to change the culture in corporate offices. They said it's the best success we've had. Executives said that we've been marketing candidates ever since Reagan, kind of the way we market toothpaste, and this is the best success we've ever had. And so yes, it's going to change the way we do things within the corporate system. You know, see what's going on. It's not a law of nature. You know, it's been different in the past. I mean, the New Deal measures, the 1960s Great Society measures, so-called. They were a response to large-scale public pressure, activism, organization, and striking fear into the hearts of the principal architects of policy, seriously. So, for example, in another dimension, if you look at the Pentagon Papers, famous Pentagon Papers, there's a very interesting part which is never reported. I think it's the most interesting part. It refers to the last couple of months. That's early 1968, after the Tet Offensive, which caused great surprise. After the Tet Offensive, Lyndon Johnson, the president, wanted to send a couple hundred thousand more troops to Vietnam. But the Joint Chiefs of Staff were opposed because they said we're going to need those troops for civil disorder control in the United States. If we continue to escalate the war, it's going to get out of control. There's going to be uprisings among the minorities, women, young people, others. And we're not going to be able to control it without force. So they didn't send the troops. That's why it's not reported, though it's the most interesting part of the Pentagon Papers. It carries lessons, just as the New Deal and the Great Society did. Well, a lot depends. I mean, one good effect of the Obama campaign is it energized a lot of people. Maybe with illusions, for the wrong reason, but it did energize them. There's a name for them in the coverage and campaign literature. They're called Obama's Army. So the Army is out there, and according to, if you read the statements of the campaign managers and the administration, they have a role. The role of Obama's Army is to wait until they get instructions from the maximal leader, and then get out there and work to put forward what's called Obama's brand, Brand Obama. That's their job. Well, they may accept that conception, or they may not, and may decide to go in an independent path. And a lot turns on the answer to that question, quite a lot, in fact. Well, there are different segments of the public. You see them in the demonstrations that are taking place right now, the right-wing protests, you know, Obama's communists taking away liberty and plot, you know, all that. You've read all that. Well, it is pretty common to ridicule it, but I think that's the wrong, and it's true, there's a lot of nonsense, but that's the wrong response, I think. These people have real grievances. For one thing, a lot of them are protesting the handouts, like the bailouts, and they're right to protest. Furthermore, a lot of them are people who have just been shafted for the last 30 years during the neoliberal period, during which wages have stagnated or declined, benefits have declined, services have collapsed. And they don't see any reason why that should happen to them. I mean, good, hardworking people, honest and so on. Why is this happening to me and my family? And nobody's giving them any answers, except Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck. Crazy answers, but they are answers. If you listen, I spend a lot of time listening to these things. They have an inner logic to them. You listen to talk radio and you sort of suspend disbelief. What's going on? That's not a joke. Forget what's going on in the world, just listen. It provides an answer which has an internal logic, and it's appealing to an aggrieved population. What we ought to be asking ourselves, we should be ridiculing it. We should say, why aren't we doing that? Why aren't we realizing that? Now, that's the matter. Peace and social justice movements. And it's a failure which brings some historical resonance. I'm old enough to remember from the 30s. This is quite reminiscent of the late days of Weimar Germany and the Nazi propaganda of the period, which also responded to a population with grievances, real grievances. It gave them answers, crazy answers, but they were coherent. You know, it's the Jews, the Bolsheviks, and so on. And now Rush Limbaugh, it's the rich liberals who own the corporations and don't care about fly-by America, you know, the ignorant meddlesome outsiders, and so on. That's the answer they're getting, and we remember what happened. It's useful to remember that in the 1920s, Germany was the most civilized part of the world. It was the peak of Western civilization. The sciences, the arts, it was the most democratic society in many ways. And 10 years later, it was the absolute abyss of human history. It's something to think about. I don't want to draw historical parallels too closely, but there's things to keep in mind. Anyway, the right response, I think, to the right-wing demonstrations is not ridicule. That's easy. But the right response is to ask ourselves why they're organizing them and not us. They're not going to hear answers from the liberal Democrats, because they don't tell them the answer. They don't want to say it's the fault of the policies we've been pursuing. So they're not going to hear that from them, and they're left with nothing. Well, let's turn briefly to foreign policy. There is a general thesis, which is pretty accurate. The spectrum of foreign policy is pretty narrow, and quite often it's well to the right of the population, to the militant, jingoist side of the population. So just take a couple of current examples, today's headlines. The headlines, big headlines today, everybody's concerned, is Iran. The Security Council passed a resolution a couple of weeks ago, right after Obama's speech at the United Nations, Resolution 1887, and the Iranians are defying headlines. They're also defying the International Atomic Energy Agency with their, they're concealing, in fact, that's today's headline in the San Francisco Chronicle. And the question is, are they building warheads in secret? And if they are, what are we going to do about it? We have to do something to protect the world from the Iranian threat. Well, so are they, what lies behind this? It's interesting if you look. There are some who are building warheads, but not in secret. One of them is India. So if you read the business press, they greeted the Security Council resolution by announcing, I'm quoting, that they can now build nuclear weapons with the same destructive power as those in the arsenals of the world's major nuclear powers. The U.S. and the Russians. That's, of course, going to spur, and already is spurring, Pakistani development of nuclear weapons. So that's not secret. That's not concealed. It's public. It's concealed from the American public, but that doesn't mean it's concealed. It's there, and you can find out about it. And what about the International Atomic Energy Agency? It's a deep concern about, you read today in the papers, about, you know, whether they found out something about Iranian and the nuclear weapons programs, or maybe they didn't. It's a big debate. There's no debate about other violations of the international agency. 2 weeks ago, they passed a resolution demanding that Israel join the non-proliferation treaty, like India, it's not, hasn't signed it, and open up its nuclear facilities to inspection. Now, the United States and Europe tried to block the resolution, but they failed. The resolution was voted, it passed, and they voted against it. Okay, the U.S. and Europe voted against it. Yesterday's papers presented information, it seemed verified, that Obama had assured Israel that he would not use, he would protect them from any effort to get them to expose their nuclear facilities to inspection. Well, all that's not concealed. Maybe it's concealed from the public, like I haven't seen any report of it. But it's all correct, you can verify it. And in fact, if you look back at that UN resolution that we're now concerned that Iran is defying, I'd suggest just reading it. You can pick it up on the internet. This short, simple resolution. It's not directed against Iran. It says nothing about Iran. There's no implications for Iran. It's directed very specifically against the United States, India, Pakistan, and Israel. What it says is, first of all, it calls for the use of peaceful means in the case of any concern over nuclear issues. That means it's opposing those who are calling for violent means. There's only two in the world, the United States and Israel. Now, both of them are threatening the use of force. Even the threat is a violation of the UN Charter. The resolution that was just passed condemns that, which is settled by peaceful means. So that's directed against the U.S. and Israel explicitly. And its further provisions say that the non-proliferation treaty should be the cornerstone of nuclear weapons concerns. Well, there are three countries that have never signed the non-proliferation treaty, only three, India, Pakistan, and Israel. And they have developed, all three have developed and are developing their nuclear weapons programs with U.S. support. That's the core of it. That's us. In the case of Pakistan, its nuclear weapons programs were the gift of Ronald Reagan. He was strongly supported the most vicious, extremist, radical nationalist leader in Pakistan's history, Zia-ul Haq, who was devoting himself to radical Islamization of Pakistan with consequences that are right before us. And Reagan didn't want to interfere with that, so the Reagan administration pretended that they didn't know that Pakistan was developing nuclear weapons. Of course, they knew. Okay, so we're now stuck with Pakistani nuclear weapons and radical Islamization of Afghanistan and Pakistan. Now, that's the Reagan administration, but it's not the view from around here. So if you go over to the Hoover Institution a couple of miles away, then you can read that Reagan's spirit seems to stride over the country, watching us like a warm and friendly ghost. You don't hear much rhetoric like that in the world, apart from Stanford and County 9. Pakistani radical Islamization and Pakistani nuclear weapons. In the case of India, last year, the United States signed a treaty with India, permitting it to evade the restrictions that are imposed on countries that are developing nuclear weapons but haven't signed the non-proliferation treaty. So now the United States and others can provide India with support for its nuclear facilities. They say civilian, but can easily be transferred to weapons production, frees up facilities for weapons production. And that's why India can now announce openly and proudly that they can produce nuclear warheads at the level of the United States and Russia. Israel, I don't have to comment on. So there's three serious threats. Those are the ones that the resolutions are directed against. Those are the ones that the international agency is concerned about in the resolutions that we don't talk about. It's happening right before our eyes, but we're concentrating on whether Iran is evading the inspection regime they're assigned under the NPT. They're supposed to be defying the international community, but if you ask who they're defying, it's Washington and whoever goes along with it. Most of the countries in the world strongly support Iran's right to develop nuclear energy. Now, that even includes U.S. favorites like Lula, President of Brazil, just in the news yesterday, won the Olympics. Well, the U.S. praises him. He's considered, you know, the good guy, moderate in Latin America, fending off the bad guy, Chavez. Lula's come out very strongly in support of Iran, actually much stronger than Chavez. That's kept quiet. It's the wrong story. But he's expressing the view of the global south. They say Iran has the same rights as anyone else. It actually includes the American population. The majority of the American population thought during the last poll a couple of years ago that Iran should have the right to enrich uranium like anyone else. So international community is a very odd notion. There's a lot of talk right now about Obama's shifting, reconstructing, rearranging the missile defense program in Eastern Europe. So, question, is he selling out to the Russians, or is he taking rational steps to protect the world, the West, from the threat of Iranian attack? And that's the current debate, a very lively debate. Totally beside the point. It's evading every imaginable issue. Anyone who's got a gray cell function knows that there is no threat of an Iranian attack. If Iran had missiles and nuclear weapons, if it even tried to load a missile, the country would be incinerated. And the ruling clerics, a bunch of gangsters, but they don't want their possessions and them destroyed. And the chances that if they want to defend themselves, if Europe wants to defend itself, it might set up maybe an asteroid defense system that's more likely than Iran. It's understood. Brzezinski is one of the more clear-headed of the foreign policy. I recently gave a speech in which he said that the missile defense system is a non-existent technology against a non-existent threat. Russian intelligence specialists estimated it infinitesimal for obvious reasons. Now, that's not to say that the anti-missile system doesn't have any function. It does. It's a first-strike weapon. That's what anti-missile systems are. They're, and it's understood on all sides. Their possible function, if they ever work, is to overcome a deterrent to a first strike. Say, okay, we can strike you, and the U.S. has a first strike policy against non-nuclear states. We can, and everyone's given it up, we can strike you, and you won't be able to retaliate, because our system will protect us from retaliation. It's the only imaginable function of an anti-missile system, and the debate about the topic is simply beside the point. This sad issue does not arise. It's like the threats of force. It's another form of threat that says we can destroy you, and you won't be able to do anything about it. Well, these are the issues that ought to be discussed. I mean, of the many crises around, and there are many of them, there are two that really do threaten survival. One is the nuclear threat, the other is the environmental threat. And in both cases, the tendencies are not good. They're in the wrong directions. Now, anything can mobilize the public. A concern for decent survival ought to do it, but that's going to require work. It's not going to happen by itself. It has to overcome massive propaganda, both from the business world and from the elite sectors generally. They just don't want to talk about it. For those who are concerned to build democracy, meaning below. There are many large challenges ahead, but there are encouraging prospects. I don't think it's a gloomy outlook. It's a much more civilized country today than it was, say, 40 years ago. Take a look, say, at the 2008 elections. I didn't like any of the candidates, but nevertheless, there was something new in American history. You couldn't have imagined 40 years ago, if it might have 10 years ago, that the Democrats would have two candidates, a woman and an African American. Whether you like them or not, that's a big change. It's a change in consciousness in the population. And the same is true in many other domains. It's a result of the activism of the 1960s, mostly young people, and its aftermath, and the aftermath was enormous. So the feminist movement, which has probably changed the country more than any of the others in the last generation, that's mostly from the 1970s, when the seeds were planted in the 60s, but it really took off in the 70s. The same is true of the environmental movement. Didn't exist in the 60s, barely existed, but it took off in the 70s and later. The anti-nuclear movement, which was huge in the early 80s, 80% of the population, that's the 1980s. The solidarity movements with the Third World are something completely new in the history of imperialism. Nobody ever went to a Third World country to try to protect the victims of the attack of the imperial power. Never happened before. But it happened in the 80s on a very substantial scale. It's extended since. The global justice movements are a product of the last decade. All of that's changed. Same is true of opposition to aggression. And it's had an effect. If you go back to the 1960s, most of this is kind of wiped out of consciousness purposely, like the Pentagon Papers report that I mentioned. But if you go back to the 60s, what actually happened is that in 1962, John F. Kennedy invaded South Vietnam. Serious attack. That's when he sent the Air Force to start bombing South Vietnam. That's when he authorized chemical warfare to destroy food crops and ground cover, started programs to drive ultimately millions of people into what amounted to concentration camps. That's a pretty serious attack. Protest was zero. You couldn't get anybody even to listen to you. I remember it very well. The protest did finally develop, but it was about 5 years later. And by that time, South Vietnam had been practically wiped out. There were half a million American troops there. The rest of Indochina was in flames. Yeah, by that time, it started getting some protests. Well, compare it to the invasion of Iraq. That's the first war in history that I know of, which was massively protested before it was officially launched. And in fact, the U.S. could not use the tactics that it freely used in Vietnam. And nor could Reagan in the 1980s, his terrorist wars in Central America, couldn't use U.S. troops, had to use mercenaries. Bad enough, it's horrible in fact, but could have been a lot worse. Same in Iraq. They could not involve themselves in anything like the manner of the 60s, where it happened without protest. No B-52 saturation bombing, no chemical warfare. All of the tactics that were perfectly normal in the 60s were just out of the question. All of that is a reflection of the increased civilization of the country. In fact, it's happening right now in Honduras. The United States has been carrying out military coups in Latin America, you know, far back as you want to go, their routine. This is the first time that I can remember when there's a military coup in Latin America which U.S. elites favor. It's a class-based coup, and they like it, but they can't directly support it. Not only did the U.S. not carry it out, but it's not even publicly supporting it. I mean, the Obama administration is dragging its feet on doing anything about it. That's a fact, response to the fact that we're not doing enough about it to make it. So they're behind Latin America and Europe in trying to do something about it, and they have the most leverage. But nevertheless, they're not carrying it out. And that's a significant change. Now, all of these things, and there's a lot more, are indications of, I think, quite a substantial opposition to aggression. In fact, Iraq is, in a way, even more striking. the United States has been compelled step by step to back down from its original war aims. Now, in large measure, this is just the result of Iraqi resistance. In fact, attributed to nonviolent resistance. People who are interested in nonviolence pay a lot of attention to it. The U.S. forces could kill insurgents with plenty of killing power, but they couldn't deal with hundreds of thousands of people in the streets. So they were compelled to accept elections. They were compelled to accept the nationalist regime. And as late as November 2007, it's not that long ago, the Bush administration was insisting that any status of forces agreement should include the right, U.S. right to have permanent military presence, and should include privileged access to Iraqi resources for U.S. corporations. Well, at least on paper, they had to give that up. Whether the U.S. will live up to it is another question. It's up to us again. At least they had to give it up in the face of Iraqi resistance and popular opposition here. These forces make a difference, slow, but significant. The U.S. is not intending to give up there, that's for sure. Obama has announced already that what are called embassies, these are huge cities inside cities, like in Iraq, there's a mega embassy, which is like no embassy in the world. Obama's expanding it. Its costs for this last year were $1.5 billion, going up to $1.8 next year and the following year. And they're building, Obama's announced they're going to build similar mega embassies in Pakistan, Islamabad, and Afghanistan, a couple that's clearly indicating an intention to have a long-term, large-scale presence there. As for the military bases all over Iraq, we don't know what's happening to them. They're just not reported. They weren't built to be abandoned. We don't know what's happening. They're probably staying. Well, it's not giving up, but these are important changes. And there are important developments elsewhere, too. Latin America is extremely important. In many ways, the most exciting place in the world in the last several years. It's for the first time in 500 years since the European conquests, Latin America is moving towards a degree of independence. And it's also beginning to face its awful internal problems. And we see that regularly. The U.S. was kicked out of its last military base in Latin America, in South America just a couple of weeks ago, Ecuador. The Obama administration is now negotiating for 7 new military bases. Use of them in Colombia's last holdout, and in Panama, which is practically a colony, but it's been thrown out everywhere else. U.S. is reacting. It's the Fourth Fleet, the naval fleet that deals with the waters around South America and the Caribbean, that was reactivated last year. It had been disbanded in 1950. Training of Latin American officers is increasing. It's now higher, at a higher level than during the Cold War, and they have an explicit mission. The mission is to combat radical populism. It's a term that has a very clear meaning in the Latin American context, and those of you with some memory will know what it means. In any event, it's slipping out of control, and that's quite serious. At the time when the Nixon administration was preparing the overthrow of the Allende government in Chile, the National Security Council pointed out that if we can't control Latin America, how are we going to control the world? That's pretty serious. And Latin America is slipping out of control. And elsewhere, too, the world is becoming more diverse, more complex, raises a lot of new problems, a lot of new concerns, but also a lot of prospects for international solidarity in confronting very serious global problems. So there are large challenges, but there are, I think, encouraging prospects. Though, as always in the past, there aren't going to be any gifts from above. There never have been, there never will be.